All right, pop quiz. February. Our series was called What? Go. No, that was March. February, our series was called what? Familyfication. The prize is my admiration to you, Hamish. March. Oh, someone first over here. Judy. Oh, I'm so sorry. Judy's like, that's my prize. March, the series was called what? Drift No More. Right. And that was our Lenten season series. Welcome to our series for April. It is called Live No Lies. It's our series for Eastertide. So welcome to Eastertide. What is Eastertide? It is this church season we now find ourselves in from the resurrection to the time of ascension, Jesus' ascension. So that's coming up in the future for us. We've just been through Lent. We've just been through Holy Week. Last Sunday, we gathered for Resurrection Sunday. And at the conclusion of Resurrection Sunday, we now entered Eastertide. We are in Eastertide. And the big question of Eastertide is what? Because all of these church seasons have reasons. They all have purposes for being in the rhythm of our year. They all have purposes for being in the cadence of the Christian life. What is the big question of Eastertide? What is the big thing? It is this. What do we actually do with the resurrection? Like, what is the resurrection? Man, I really like that that came from over here. That was something's in the air today. What do we do with what just happened? So traditionally, when we've done Eastertide in this community, we've looked at the texts after the resurrection. We've looked at the guys on the road to Emmaus. We've looked at the stories of Jesus appearing resurrected. We've prodded around in those texts and we've had a good look. What do these texts mean? What has happened? Christ was crucified. Christ has risen. What has that done? What the big deal? So at a high level, here are some answers for Eastertide this year. Well, if Christ has risen, he has inaugurated the end. He has begun the end. Death has been defeated. Death is no more a thing. Death does not have the final word. Death does not have a sting. To use, man, that sort of rhymed, that had like a nice flow to it just there. God's presence has been established, not just in some place in Israel, but in Christ. Christ, who is the new temple, the walking around temple of God. And God's mission to make all things new, the work he is doing from the start of the scriptures to the end, God's mission to make all things new has burst into the world and found a place in history through Christ's resurrection. Victory has been sealed. Christ has won the war. But at the coalface of life, we might have some questions about all of that. Why is there still suffering in the world, Dan, if Christ has won the war? Why are we still dying if Christ has won the war? Why do we still struggle? Why do we still groan? Why are things fully not as they should be? I know what the news feed is like week in, week out. It is not great news a lot of the time. It seems to me that there's still a job we have to do to continue in the mission of what God is doing and making all things new. And yet sometimes we just don't want to. Sometimes apathy, lethargy, self-consumption just seem to take over and win. And the church isn't so missional after all. Sometimes things just don't go to plan. The things we thought we would do, we just don't get to, do we? So it's not about all things being made new, as Resurrection Sunday reminded us. Sometimes a week into Eastertide, we are like, something's being made new. And maybe a couple more weeks into Eastertide, we're like, a couple of things being made new would be great. And then maybe by the end of Eastertide, we're like, it would be great if just anything could be made new. Why is this? Why is that? It is because while the war has been won, there are still battles yet to fight within it. It's a well-used analogy, but it's a really good one. I've spoken out of this before, but I'd like to speak out of it again because it is so helpful. The history books tell us that World War II ran from the 1st of September 1939, that's when war was declared, to the 2nd of September 1945, that is when total war and victory was announced. And in this time frame, these 6 years, we have some other important dates that are worth paying attention to. For example, the European Theatre of War, Victory in Europe Day, ended on the 8th of May 1945. That was when victory was announced in the European theatre. That was when the Nazis were conquered, they had surrendered, and peace had come to the European theatre. In the Pacific theatre, in the Japanese front, victory in the Pacific was on the 14th of August 1945. So we have these victory days, victory in Europe, victory in the Pacific, and total war is over 2nd of September 1945. Those are the victory days, the days the war was over. But the interesting thing about the war is this. While those dates were in fact the days that victories were announced and the war was officially won, there was an earlier decisive moment that turned the entire war and in effect won it. That day was D-Day on the 6th of June 1944. This was the day, if you know your war history, you know what I'm talking about here. This was the day the Allies landed on France soil, French soil. This was the day they arrived in the European theater from the west. So already the Allies were coming up through Africa from the south. Already the Russians were coming in from the east. But this was the day they arrived from the west. Nazi Germany was now surrounded by those who were trying to eradicate evil from the world. And this meant one really big piece. Supply lines were now opened up into Europe in a way they never had been before. The Allies were ready, they were locked and loaded, and supplies were built up to start coming in and streaming in through this Western Front. And now the war was over. It was won. It was just a matter of time from here. And historians agree, D-Day was the day the war was effectively won. However, victory was not sealed until the 2nd of September 1945. But the truth remains, D-Day is the day the war turned. There were still many, many battles to fight. It was just a matter of time and resources from here. Now I show you this because it is still one of the most helpful analogies that comes to mind when we think about what it is to be a Christ follower. Easter is our D-Day. Easter is the day the beachhead was landed upon. It was the day that the supplies of heaven came ashore and prepared the supply lines for all of history to come. Victory was assured. Easter is our D-Day. But there are still battles to fight. There are still fronts that need to be pushed forward. Total victory is yet to come. Jesus is heralding in that future of victory in the world. It will be right and it will be peace again. But in the meantime, we find ourselves in this tension of the D-Day reality and the war-ending reality. We live in the tension of these two places and times. Is this making sense? It's really helpful stuff. The great Vineyard theologian, Derek Morphew, the South African, who is just absolutely stunning at this stuff, he says this, I want to show you this. The New Testament teaches that there is both kingdom now and kingdom not yet. Our Christian experience takes place within this tension. The Christian is a glorious contradiction. Here's the contradiction. We are new creatures. We are new. With new natures. Yet, we war against the flesh. Anyone feeling that contradiction? God always leads us in triumph. Yet, our lives seem to be one long battle. Anyone else feeling the tension? As we look within ourselves, we sometimes feel victorious and joyful and free. Yet, these moments are quickly replaced by feelings of great weakness, fear, and groaning from which we long to escape. Understanding the tension of the kingdom is essential to measure truth. What am I saying? Take you back to that diagram. What I'm saying is we are living in the post-D-Day moment, but the victory in Europe Day is still ahead of us, and we live in the tension of that battle. And in Eastertide, we are reminded that we live in the great tension of life. We are the victory people, yet we are still battling and battling and battling. Why? We live in the tension of the battles to fight within the war that has already been won. Which brings me to a really interesting observation that I would like to make today pastorally. John Mark Comer puts it like this: our generation has the lowest comfort level with military metaphors and faith. We prefer to think of following Jesus as a journey or a lifestyle rather than a war. There are a few things that I can utter as a pastor with this microphone in my hand that will make you get a cold sweat. I'll say one of them now. Money. I know that. If I start to do that on you, some of you start to have a little reaction in your body. Another one, I'll do another one just for fun. Serving. I'll do one more. Showing up on time. Preach. But there's another big one. There's another big one that I can say, and I know it will get reactions for all of us. Spiritual warfare. Spiritual warfare. You know, for a bunch of you, you're actually thinking, where's the door? I'm out of here now. Talk of our faith as warfare is really hard going for some of us. For many of us, I think. We don't like this language. It seems to be a little incongruent with the Jesus language. But yet, I think what it is that it's because there's a lot of baggage that actually comes with this. And often it has been validated with painful and traumatic experiences of what it has been like to be on the other side of people conducting themselves in the name of spiritual warfare in unhealthy ways. You know, some of the weirdest things I have seen done in church have been done by people who are fixated on spiritual warfare. The weirdest things. Some of the most hurtful things that I've seen in church and pastor some people through is because of people poorly doing spiritual warfare. Some of the most hurtful things have been in the name of spiritual warfare. And yet, that's a common theme today. Some of the most powerful and miraculous things that I have seen in the church and in people's lives have been because of people with wisdom and care doing spiritual warfare well. It's a glorious contradiction, to use Derek Morphew's language from earlier. It's often a misunderstood facet of our faith. A lot of us throw the baby out with the bathwater with this one. I don't want anything to do with it. Sometimes it's being co-opted by things that just aren't biblical. That hasn't helped. And I'll just be honest. I'm going to be really honest with you right now. Whew, courageous conversation moment from Dan. Sometimes spiritual warfare can be like a scapegoat. It can be a scapegoat. You know, we say I'm under attack or it's a spiritual attack, when actually it's just covering up an emotional immaturity, or a fear, or just a bad choice, or just the world being the world. We say, I'm under attack. No, you're just a Muppet. Preach. Spiritual warfare can be messy, it can be weird, it can be scary, it can be confronting. But also, yet, spiritual warfare can be liberating. It can be effective. We can see the triumphs of God's kingdom in ways that our passivity and our apathy never can. It's a sign of the kingdom of God breaking in amongst us, for crying out loud. It can set us free. So I ask this question. If we were a church of no spiritual warfare, are we a church of the kingdom? So what do we do with that? Here's my proposal today. We need to wisely make friends with our faith as a spiritual battle. And I put the word wisely in there really, really proactively today. We need to intentionally and carefully and considerately and kindly figure out what it is to have a faith that is one of spiritual battle. Why? Because when we do not do it carefully and intentionally and considerately and kindly, other people are the casualties on the other side of our misfires. Other people are the casualties. When we misfire, it's other people who get hurt. Many have been hurt, a bunch of you even in this room, even the one holding the microphone preaching to you today, from being on the other side of spiritual battle misfires that have not been handled with wisdom and care. So we are not kidding around with this series. We are not joking around too much. We are actually being very seriously that we want to do this wisely, because when it is done wisely, when we conduct our life in a spiritual battle well, it is both beautiful and effective. So, how do we start to build a picture of wisdom here today as we introduce this series? Well, the early followers of Jesus had a three-piece paradigm of what it was to be in a spiritual battle. These were their three things: the world, the flesh, and the devil. These were the three enemies of the soul. They were the counter-trinity to the Trinity himself. And so to find a little bit about this, let's just look at some text today. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 2. And we're going to look at a little bit of stuff from St. Paul this morning. So firstly, Ephesians 2. Once you were dead because of your disobedience and your many sins, you used to live in sin just like the rest of the world, obeying the devil, the commander of the powers in the unseen world. He is the spirit at work in the hearts of those who refuse to obey God. All of us used to live that way, following the passionate desires and the inclinations of our sinful nature. By our very nature, we were subject to God's anger, just like everyone else. So to St. Paul here, there's a little caricature of the devil being played out here as the commander of the powers of the unseen world. The spirit at work in the hearts of those who refuse to obey God. Later on in Ephesians 6, he fleshes this out a little bit further. This isn't amongst, most of you will know this passage, it's about God's spiritual armor. This is the little piece of that. A final word: be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on all of God's armor so that you will be able to stand firm against all the strategies of the devil. For we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. So in those two texts, we're seeing a couple of things play out. We have this fleshly nature, this desire that's living out inside of us. We have this devil, this caricature, and we also have this thing of the world that is around us. So to Paul, these battles are raging on amongst this big victory of what Christ has done. If you've read Paul, you know that he's not a defeatist. He can see the victory. But he's also telling us where the battlefronts are. The battlefronts are the devil, the world, and the flesh. He summarizes it up to his protege Timothy like this: fight the good fight for the true faith. Fight the good fight for the true faith. Now just imagine with me for a moment that Paul is not writing to Timothy anymore. Imagine with me, just engage your imaginations for one moment with me. This letter is not to someone else. This letter is to you. And I ask you this question: what does the word fight do for you today? How are you reacting to that word? What does it conjure up in you? What do you feel in your body as we say things like fight the good fight? Just a moment. No one has to say anything, but just what is that doing to you? Please pay attention. You know, I suspect for some of us, we have some work to do at making friends with this. I suspect for some of us, we're completely fine with it. I suspect for some of us, we might need some correction on this. And I suspect for some of us, we might need some training in this. It's like, I want to fight, but I just have not got in the gym. I do not know what to do. I suspect some of us may even need some more convincing. But just think with me for a moment here. To fight is active. To fight is present tense. And to fight is up to you. And so how are you fighting? What are you fighting? And how is the fight going? One last question from St. Paul. This time it's from his letters to the Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians 9, 26 to 27, he says this, "So I run with purpose in every step. I'm not just shadow boxing. I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, I might myself be disqualified." Paul here is using a really interesting phrase. He uses this phrase here. I'm not just shadow boxing. What is shadow boxing? Shadow boxing is when a boxer just pretends to fight an invisible opponent. They get in the ring and they throw some punches and they do some ducking. I'm not going to give it a very good example because I'm not very good at any of it. But you know what I mean, right? They're in the ring with themselves and they're ducking and they're diving and they're, you know. Paul is saying here, that's not what faith is. We're not just shadow boxing here. We're not just in the ring by ourselves fighting an imaginary opponent. He says, no, my spiritual formation is not being formed against shadows. I'm not just playing pretend. I'm actually disciplining myself for real. The fight is for real. This is not a fake one. So how do we do it well? Well, it brings me to introducing to you the book that we've framed this series out of. This is the book called Live No Lies. It's by our friend John Mark Comer. And it is terrific. And I actually think, after the back of Cameron and Gemma's invitation to the young adults at Being, was it 20 to 30-ish? I love the vagueness of that. Because I am still 30-ish. See you guys there. I actually think that if all of this language today is like hitting home for you, especially if you're a young adult, this is the book of your generation. I actually mean that. I mean, the ruthless elimination of hurry, it's all right. This book is brilliant. This book is prophetic. This book is crucial. This book is provocative. Ooh. What does John Mark Comer do in this book? He outlines the three enemies of the soul that I've just told you about, the world, the devil, and the flesh. And he identifies them as the battlefront. And then he says, and how does it all work? Well, it all works through lies. All three enemies use lies to spiritually deform us. And in this book, John Mark lays out a strategic plan of how to overcome them. All of this, all of which could be called spiritual warfare. So personally, when I read that book a couple of years ago when it first came out, it took my passivity for spiritual warfare and it clicked it into gear. It was back on the table for me in a very real way. My apathy flicked off and I became engaged again. And it did it through a more historical understanding of it. It wasn't like a pump up. It was more like this chasing of wisdom. Suddenly, I had a more current reality of it. Spiritual warfare is not just for a certain corner of our church, guys. It's not just for a certain bunch of people with certain giftings. It is for all of us because we are all living in the culture of great lies. And Jesus comes as the truth to offer us peace. So I want to show you the guts of John Mark's argument here. We're going to be speaking out of this book for the next couple of weeks, but here is the main piece that he is trying to get us to see. He says this, "Our war against the three enemies of the soul is not a war of guns and bombs. It's not against other people at all. It's a war on lies. And the problem is less that we tell lies, and it's more that we live them. We let false narratives about reality into our bodies and they wreak havoc in our souls. So here's my working theory as followers of Jesus. We are at war with the world, the flesh, and the devil. And the three enemies stratagem is as followed." I'd highly recommend you take a photo of this if you're not going to be buying the book. This is the book condensed down into a couple little sections here. This is how it works. Firstly, the devil gives us deceptive ideas. He gives us the lies in the first place. And then those lies play out in disordered desires in our bodies and in our flesh and in our living. And lastly, those deceptive and disordered desires are normalized in a sinful society, which we can call the world. So deceptive ideas that play to disordered desires that are normalized in a sinful society. The devil, the flesh, the world. This is John Mark Comer's thesis of this book. And then he says here, recognize and resist the three enemies that sabotage your peace. These are not the stories of peace. He goes on to say this a little bit later, and I think this is where it's important for all of us to pay attention. He says, I have a soul, you have one too, and your soul, like mine, is locked in a war with lies. Again, this is not just for a certain corner of our church, this is for all of us. I think John Mark is right. The battlefront edge of this battle is for all of us. We all have a soul, and our souls are all locked in the same battle, the one that's raging on around us every day, the war of lies, not just being said, but being lived. And so the book title is called Live No Lies. And that is the title for our Eastertide series. The battle that we fight every day within the war that has been won. Jesus' resurrection won the war, but yet there is still battle fronts that we live on every day. And live no lies is one of the key ones. So for Eastertide, here's what we're going to do for the next couple of weeks. For the next 3 weeks, we're going to explore each of these three enemies of our souls. So next week, for the first time ever in the life of Central Vineyard, I'll be doing a sermon on the devil. How is the devil the one who gives us these deceptive ideas? What do we do about that? How do we fight wisely? The week after that, Leish is going to be doing a talk on the flesh. She's going to be looking at how these lies play out and these disordered desires in all of us. And then the Sunday after that, we're going to conclude the series with looking at the world, how lies are normalized in a sinful society around us every day. And in all of this, we are looking for something. How do we wisely fight the good fight together? Jesus has won the war. D-Day has come. Easter is the beachhead that was formed. A week ago, that is what we celebrated. If you're with us or you listened in on the podcast, that was the beautiful work of Resurrection Sunday. The power of God winning the war planted upon the beachhead. But make no mistake, there is still a battle that has raged on towards total victory. And so how do we fight this fight well, that our souls may flourish? What does it mean to remain faithful to the way of Jesus and only Jesus? How do we live wisely against an enemy who is out to get us? How do we not slip into deception and deformation? How do we live courageously against temptations of the world and of the liar himself? How do we make sure that we are being intentional about living no lies? That is what the next 3 weeks are going to cover. Will you please come back? Will you come back? Okay, cool. So, allow me today, in concluding our introduction, to pass on a benediction to you. The benediction is this. May this be good for your soul. The war is won, but there is still a battle within. So may you become, in Derek Morphew's language, a glorious contradiction. May you become a person who has a soul of this new nature of peace, joy, and love. Amongst the work of an enemy of lies, the flesh that could embody those lies, and the world normalizing those lies. My benediction today is this: may you live no lies. Amen.